Welcome to 2021, everyone. The year's getting off to an intense start. The epicenter of the American political universe for the early part of this week is the state of Georgia. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Today on Point, we're going to make sense of two big Georgia stories. Because tomorrow, voters there decide who their two senators will be. In a few minutes, we'll take a look at why the state has a high-stakes runoff system anyway. But today, we're going to start with this.
So what are we going to do here, folks? I only need 11,000 votes. Fellas, I need 11,000 votes. Give me a break.
That's from extraordinary audio of a Saturday phone call between President Donald Trump and Georgia's Secretary of State, Brad Raffensperger. First reported by the Washington Post, in the call, Trump repeatedly cajoles, bullies, and even tries to threaten the Secretary of State into altering the results of Georgia's presidential vote, a tally, by the way, which has already been recounted and certified by the state. So Paula Reed, CBS News White House correspondent, joins us to talk about it. Hello, Paula.
So great to be with you.
And On Point News analyst Jack Beatty is also with us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Meghna. Hello, Paula.
Okay, first, Paula, just tell us a little bit more about what is in this hour-long phone call whose audio was released to the world yesterday.
So I have to say, what really struck me before I get into the summary is that we haven't heard from the president in several weeks. He really hasn't been giving long interviews. He hasn't been doing press conferences or press availabilities. We really haven't heard sort of an unfiltered speech by President Trump in quite some time now. Reading the transcript of this call, it brought it all back. This is exactly how the president deals with members of his own administration, foreign leaders, reporters, when he wants to pressure them to basically cede to his narrative or his worldview. And in this call, he speaks for quite some time, rattling off a series of unsubstantiated allegations about voter fraud in the state of Georgia. And then you have the Secretary of State, a Republican official, and some other election officials on the call who are adamant. They listen to the president, they hear him out, and they just say, Mr. President, you have some bad information. We have looked into this. This is not true, what you were saying. The president repeats his claims. They repeat their stance that they have been investigated, and it goes on and on throughout the call. But the president, it just continues to pressure them to find just enough votes to overturn President-elect Biden's victory in the state. And now it's raising a lot of questions about whether this conduct raises to the level of criminality.
So this is the key thing here, right? Because the president repeatedly says throughout the call, he makes claims, again, unsubstantiated or without evidence, that he believes he won Georgia by several hundred thousand votes. But he basically tells Raffensperger over and over again, but I just need 11,000. So it doesn't even matter. He's not even in the tape. He's not, or in the phone call, he's not seeking the overall truth. He just wants enough votes so that Georgia can flip to the Trump category. So let's listen to a little bit, Paula and Jack. We've pulled some longish kind of cuts from this hour-long phone conversation. Here's one of the multiple times that Trump urged the Georgia Secretary of State to alter the already certified vote count in Georgia.
There's nothing wrong with saying that, you know, that you've recalculated, because the 2,236 and absentee ballots, I mean, they're all exact numbers that were done by accounting firms, law firms, etc. And even if you cut them in half again, it's more votes than we need.
Well, Mr. President, the challenge that you have is the data you have is wrong. We talked to the congressman, and they were surprised. But they, I guess there was a person named Mr. Raynard that came to these meetings and presented data. And he said that there was dead people, I believe it was upward of 5,000. The actual number were two.
That second voice you heard was Brad Raffensperger, the Georgia Secretary of State. Jack Beatty, let me turn to you quickly here. What did you hear in this hour-long phone call?
Well, I heard either a bad man or a madman. Either way, someone unfit to be president. You know, he's a bad man if he's lying, if he really knows that Biden defeated him and he's just saying, please steal the election on my behalf. That disgraces us before all of American history to have a president who would do that. And he's a madman if he's delusional, if he believes that farrago of fantasies that he spills out with this, you know, 2,064 and 400 and this, you know, sort of obsessive numbering. And if he's a madman, the 25th Amendment, he needs to be removed rapidly under the 25th Amendment. Because what are we dealing with here? I think Dan Balch catches it very well. Trump, and this is his headline of his piece today, knows no limits, knows no limits. What's going to happen this week with this? 10 secretaries, former secretaries of defense, have signed a letter to the Washington Post saying, please, basically warning Trump, don't use the military to interfere in this election. Are they responding to things they're hearing from generals? Are they responding to things they're hearing from people in the Pentagon? We don't know, but Trump knows no limits.
Paul, I'm going to come back to you in just a second, but I want to play another cut here, because as both you and Jack pointed out, the president spent about the first 12 minutes of the phone call advancing right-wing conspiracy theories, essentially, making claims about officials shredding ballots, about the voting machine company Dominion secretly removing machines from various Georgia counties or replacing their parts. I mean, both the Secretary of State of Georgia and his office's general counsel, Ryan Germany, spent a lot of the call fact-checking the president. Let's listen.
What about the ballots, the shredding of the ballots? Have they been shredding ballots?
No. The only investigation that we have into that, they have not been shredding any ballots. There was an issue in Cobb County where they were doing normal, office shredding, getting rid of old stuff. And we investigated that. But this is stuff from, you know, past elections.
It doesn't pass the smell test, though, because we hear they're shredding thousands and thousands of ballots. And now what they're saying, oh, we're just cleaning up the office. I don't think that plays.
Mr. President, the problem you have with social media, people can say anything.
No, this isn't social media. This is Trump media.
Paula, what do you think?
Well, let's just note that he is distinguishing himself from social media. He's very upset with the big tech companies. We know that. But here, what's so remarkable is he's effectively accusing Democrats in the state of trying to steal the election when it appears that he is pressuring these GOP officials to at least flip the state. Not that that would necessarily give him an election victory in and of itself. And he's also, later on in the call, he starts to imply that there could be criminal liability for these GOP officials in Georgia if they don't acquiesce to his demands, which some lawyers have looked at and suggest that it looks like solicitation of election fraud.
Well, Paula,
creating
actually,
problems either the state or federal level.
We have that clip. I want folks to hear it. So here is the president, again, making unsubstantiated claims about ballots being destroyed and supposed cheating. And then he makes, as Paula points out, this accusation against the Georgia Secretary of State.
Because you know what they did and you're not reporting it. That's a criminal offense. And you know, you can't let that happen. That's a big risk to you and to Ryan, your lawyers. That's a big risk.
So, Paula, the president there basically accusing the Georgia Secretary of State of criminal activity. And again, we have to underscore that throughout this hour-long phone call, Donald Trump keeps saying, I just need 11,000 votes.
Give me a little something, something. I mean, it sounds like a negotiation with an insurance agent or something, right? It doesn't sound like a good faith effort to make sure that any and all possibility of any sort of fraud has been thoroughly investigated. It's clear that he's trying to pressure him. But again, it all comes down to this question of criminality, because this is going to be one of the first things that President-elect Biden is going to have to contend with. You have this incident and others, but let's focus on this one. Do you want to investigate this? Are you going to investigate whether there are other similar kind of conversations? Do you want to try to pursue a federal investigation into this conduct? Let's say you don't. At the state level, there's also the possibility of charges in the state of Georgia. We know lawmakers on the Hill are also calling for investigations. So now we have a whole new batch of questions about possible criminal conduct by the soon-to-be former president of the United States. It's a headache not only for himself, obviously, but for his own party and for the incoming administration.
We have a listener here who wants to know if there are other phone calls, similar phone calls to other states. Do we know, Paula?
I believe at this point, I believe that is something that reporters and potentially, if they decide to open any formal investigations at the state or federal level, that will be looked into. But certainly reporters are looking into that. We know that there's been outreach, but whether there's been anything like this, that's a question. And if there was it recorded? Because, look, as a recovering lawyer, I can tell the president probably assumes every conversation he has is recorded because many of them are leaked. But you can tell, like, a certain one half of that conversation, they knew they were being recorded, and they knew this was likely to go out. They were very careful with their words, the president less so, even though he has a reasonable expectation to think he is often being recorded.
Yeah. So, Jack, I'm going to come back to you in 1 second for a last thought here on this. But Paula, I mean, this is all happening just a couple days in advance of January 6th, when Congress is supposed to meet to certify the results of the Electoral College. And we know that at least, what, a dozen Republican members of the Senate are going to try to do what they can to muck up that process. Has this had any impact on that?
We haven't seen the impact on that, though some of those lawmakers, some of the other lawmakers in the party have come out and said this wasn't helpful. But you also, I know the rest of your show is going to be really focused on what's happening in Georgia with the runoff. And already we've seen today GOP officials coming out in that state and saying this call is not helpful, particularly when you look at what's on the line here, control of the U.S. Senate. Why are we having this kind of conversation, you know, a few days before? Although if you look at what Mark Meadows says in this call, the chief of staff, it does appear like they're just trying to at least get a concession that they'll look into it a little bit more, perhaps to push that out ahead of the runoff to bolster these claims of unfairness. But this is not helpful for the Republican Party or for the United States ahead of this runoff and certainly ahead of this certification that we do expect the certification will go through.
Well, Jack Beatty, we've got 20 seconds before we have to take the break here. Have we ever heard a president of the United States say the kinds of things that Donald Trump is saying on this tape?
No, we haven't. And Philip Roth's comment about him several years ago holds up. Trump is the evil sum of his deficiencies.
Jack Beatty, On Point News analyst, thank you very much. And Paula Reed, CBS News White House correspondent, thank you as well. When we come back, as Paula said, we will focus on Georgia and its runoffs. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I think I'm a political conservative. I'm certainly a fiscal conservative. When I first started off, I was a social conservative. And in those days, social conservative almost meant a segregationist. It meant segregationist. Let's don't push a foot around about it.
Well, that is the voice of Denmark Groover, a longtime Georgia state representative who served off and on between 1953 to 1995. He's talking there about growing up in rural Georgia in an oral history recorded by Georgia State University in 1989.
Anybody of my generation who was raised in a rural area or indeed anywhere in Georgia in those days, it says they were without racial prejudice or telling a lie.
Well, before the 1960s, Georgians had voted through what was known as the county unit system. We're going to hear more about how that worked a bit later. Its overall effect was to give more weight to white rural voters than black voters concentrated in Georgia's cities. Then in 1962, the Supreme Court declared the county unit system unconstitutional. Well, Denmark Groover proposed an alternative.
In 1963, when Sanders was governor, after the Baker decision, the one-man, one-vote rule, it was a sort of a controversy on whether we would have people elected by majority vote. I had introduced a bill to require that they be elected by majority vote.
Elections via majority vote. Essentially, Groover anticipated white Georgians splitting their votes among different candidates, while black Georgians might vote as a, quote, block, as he put it. In fact, a DeKalb County representative who supported Groover at the time recalled him saying, quote, "We have got to go the majority vote because all we have is a plurality, and the Negroes and the pressure groups and special interests are going to manipulate this state and take charge if we don't go for the majority vote." Well, a year later, Groover's idea eventually became law, creating Georgia's system of runoff voting.
Some of the people who were then of the most liberal persuasion were decrying my interest in majority vote because of their own personal political program.
Well, recall, this is 1963 and 1964, the years of John F. Kennedy's assassination, the March on Washington, the passage of the Civil Rights Act. Well, by 1989, Groover said in that oral history with Georgia State University that though he did not apologize for the past, quote, "My views have changed. I have mellowed."
In his day, I decried everything that Martin Luther King Jr. stood for. Today, I recognize that he and his philosophy and his activities probably forced me and Georgia into acts and actions and beliefs that were beneficial to all of us, including me.
So there we have the beginnings of an outline to understand how Georgia ended up with its runoff voting system, a system that today, actually especially tomorrow, could determine the future of the U.S. government as a whole, given those two Senate seats in Georgia up for grabs right now. So we want to understand more about how Georgia got here. Adrienne Jones joins us. She's an assistant professor of political science at Morehouse College. And Professor Jones, welcome to On Point.
Thank you. Hello.
And Professor Jones joins us from Atlanta. Also with us from Dallas, Texas, is Cal Gilson. He's a professor of political science at Southern Methodist University and is author of Pursuing the American Dream, Opportunity and Exclusion Over Four Centuries and the American Dream in History, Politics, and Fiction. Professor Gilson, welcome.
Thank you.
So, Professor Jones, I wonder if you could just start by a little bit by responding to what you heard there in that oral history with Denmark Groover. Could place him a little bit in Georgia history.
Yeah, that was absolutely marvelous stuff, because it's very difficult for people today to get their mind around how people thought in the South, not just Georgia, but everything from Virginia around to Texas in the 1960s and before. One of the things about Southerners in that era was that they were very straightforward on their racial views in the way people simply are not today. They would say things in very raw terms. And Denmark Groover's importance in this story is not that he was a terribly influential guy himself, but that he spoke things that many other white Southerners, and you have to say when Denmark Groover is talking, he's talking about white Southern opinion in his era. And so it gives you a flavor of what people were thinking as they built an electoral system in Georgia in the 1960s.
Well, Professor Gilson, forgive me, but that first question was intended for Professor Jones, and I understand that I've got two J names here, and I'll do my best to be as clear as possible. But I appreciate you getting us started. So, Professor Jones, let me turn back to you here. And give you a chance to answer that question. Sort of, how do you see a figure like Groover, who first proposes this idea for a runoff voting system in Georgia, as positioned it in Georgia history?
Well, I see him as personally affected by this majority rule that he wants. He is only intermittently elected over the course of the years between the 1970s and 1990s. And in 1958, he actually lost a race designed much like he's discussing in the tape, which is two white candidates and a black candidate. The white vote split, and so he did not win his seat. Instead, this black legislator won. And so he sounded much like our current president. I mean, he couldn't believe that he lost this race. He demanded a recount. And so, I mean, not only is this a popular view and often used in Georgia elections to motivate turnout, the idea that, you know, blacks might come to control the state, but also he's personally invested and wants to make sure that, particularly after the demise of the county unit system, that white candidates are able to win elections.
Yeah. So let's talk about the county unit system beforehand a little bit more, because as I mentioned earlier, in 1962, the Supreme Court found that system of voting unconstitutional. So Professor Jones, explain to us. I mean, I had actually never really heard of it until relatively recently. What was the county unit system?
The poor man's electoral college in the state of Georgia. This allowed rural control of elections. So you've got a point system where each county gets, there are 159 counties, each county gets two county unit votes per representative in the state house. So the eight highest populated counties get six, 30 counties get four, and 121 counties get two, which sounds like a small number, but leaves 121 rural counties controlling 60% of the vote. So for governor, for senator, for secretary of state, AG, you never need a majority. You only need a majority for certain offices like governor and senator in the county unit vote. And you only need a plurality of the same for things like secretary of state or attorney general. And so this allows rural counties initially to have some control over the economy, minimize taxes in farm areas, and especially once the white primary is outlawed by the Supreme Court, it helps to contain the black vote, which sits in the urban areas. And so under the county unit system, some voters outside, for example, Fulton County, where I live in Atlanta, would have multiple times the amount of vote share than of Fulton County citizens. So in some places, 11 times the amount of the worth of my vote, or 25 times in 45 other counties.
Wow.
So this allows some control over the state house and make sure that it stays white.
So Professor Gilson, then, let me ask you this. It sounds as if the county unit system was, you know, also layered in with the, you know, profound voter suppression that was happening throughout the South and including in Georgia through the Jim Crow era in the 50s and 60s as well. So was the county unit system just further disenfranchising black Georgians?
It was. The Jim Crow voter system dates from the late 19th century, the post-Reconstruction era after the Civil War, and runs all the way up into the 1940s, 50s, and 60s. And it had multiple elements. Maybe the most famous is the poll tax, which Georgia adopted in 1877 and wasn't outlawed until the 24th Amendment in 1964. So Georgia, in the late 19th century and the first decade or so of the 20th century, built an electoral system based on the poll tax, unlimited voter registration, literacy tests, grandfather clause, the white primary. And those elements of the Jim Crow electoral system stayed in place through the early decades of the 20th century and were taken apart effectively one at a time as the federal courts or the Congress outlawed various elements of the Jim Crow voter registration and electoral system. And as an element of it was struck down by the courts or the Congress, new elements were added. Mm-hmm. So that when the county unit system established in 1917 was struck down in 1963-64, the runoff system came in its place.
Right. So both of you there then here are painting this history of basically many systems of voting, particularly in Georgia, because that's what we're focusing on, based in the concept of disenfranchising black voters here. So I want to just ask both of you, Professor Gilson and Professor Jones, if you could listen along with me for a minute to Charles Bullock. He's a political science professor at the University of Georgia, author of many books on voting and the history of voting rights in the South, including runoff elections in the United States. Now, Bullock, as both of you already know, he doesn't dispute that Denmark Gruver was a segregationist at the time when he introduced the idea of runoff voting in Georgia, and that Gruver's intentions were racist. It's just that Professor Bullock says it didn't really matter given the political realities of Georgia at the time.
The problem, though, in kind of understanding where all this comes from, is that Denny Gruver did not have a political influence with the administration at that point.
And Professor Bullock says the runoff system really comes from recommendations from a committee appointed by then-Georgia Governor Sanders.
So the Gruver motion or bill does pass the House. It does not pass the Senate. It dies. There is an election study commission that the governor appoints. Gruver was not a part of it. And it is out of this election study commission that the new election code gets passed. The election code, this is a full-blown election code. It's not simply something dealing with runoffs.
So Charles Bullock tells us that before the runoff election system was fully adopted in Georgia in 1964, he says that elections at the local level in the state were frequently manipulated. He says runoffs weren't necessarily meant to suppress black voters, but rather deal with other political idiosyncrasies in the state. Charles Bullock calls them boss control.
Challengers to the county bosses, and probably about a quarter of the counties in Georgia at that time were boss controlled. But the challengers, the reformers, if it looked like they had a chance to knock off the what was known then as the courthouse clique or courthouse gang, the courthouse gang might then run a stalking horse candidate. So the effort was to have a uniform majority vote requirement. So it'd be uniformity across the state rather than these variations at the local level. And the thought was that this would weaken the power of the courthouse gangs.
Well, that's Charles Bullock, a political science professor at the University of Georgia and author of Runoff Elections in the United States. Professor Jones, respond to what Professor Bullock said there.
Well, I would certainly say that, I mean, this is politics. So not every single legislator votes for the majority system because for the same reasons that Gruver does, but many do. And so it's a mix of how to control politics in Georgia, and Georgia is not solely populated by black voters. So there are other agenda involved. And after the demise of the county unit system, it's true, the state is looking to replace that system and to figure out what the electoral systems are going to look like.
So I just wonder if I don't necessarily want to tie a neat little bow on this because history doesn't – that's not how history works here. But is it a fair assessment, Professor Jones, to say that the system of runoff voting that Georgia has today and that will be so instrumental tomorrow – That it does sound as if the whole thing is undergirded by racist intent.
There is racist intent there. I would agree with Bullock to the degree that I would argue that this worked effectively in the mid-1960s, but you haven't necessarily had enough black candidates in races with three people that have resulted in exactly the photograph of runoff election that we're talking about. It has impacted Georgia elections, however, and in modern times it has meant that Democrats don't win runoffs. And some of that is because even if we're going to go back and forth about whether or not this has racist underpinnings, runoffs are difficult for black communities. So, I mean, it continues to have an impact in the state that has a racist or a racial impact. People don't necessarily have transportation to the polls multiple times. They don't necessarily have time off of work. And in an average runoff year, which is not like this one, getting voters to be motivated to turn out a second time weeks later can be very difficult, and it definitely dampens black participation
in a
state like Georgia.
In past runoffs, we've seen participation drop by, 40, 50% even,
yes,
between the first and second rounds of voting here. Professor Gilson, we have just 30 seconds before we have to take a quick break here, but But where else is runoff voting used? And do you think it's still sort of an effective means of electing lawmakers in 2021?
Yeah, it's used in 9 or 10, really 8 or 9, probably southern states. And then a couple of other states have versions of runoff, including North Dakota, I think. And the effectiveness of runoffs as a racial device is different in different states, depending on the demographics of the state. I think that Professor Jones is right that it's not effective in Georgia, but it might well be in South Carolina and Alabama today.
Well, Cal Gilson and Adrian Jones, stand by. We're trying to understand the history of Georgia's runoff voting system and how the state got here. Here meaning tomorrow's very consequential runoff votes for two senators. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Today, we are understanding the history of how Georgia first formed its runoff voting system. It's more relevant than ever, given tomorrow's vote for two United States senators in Georgia, those senators who will determine the balance of power in the Senate and then very likely the functioning of the United States government as a whole for the next several years. I'm joined today by Adrian Jones. She's an assistant professor of political science at Morehouse College, also an attorney and directs the pre-law program at Morehouse. She joins us from Atlanta. Cal Gilson is with us. He's a professor of political science at Southern Methodist University and author of a number of books on voting and U.S. history, including Pursuing the American Dream, Opportunity and Exclusion, over four centuries. And Professor Jones and Gilson, just want to sort of ground us right in the present here. And let's listen to a little bit of what's been happening on the campaign trail in Georgia as those two runoffs wind towards their completion tomorrow. Here's Democrat John Ossoff, who's facing Republican David Perdue. He was on Fox over the weekend at a campaign stop, and he was asked about attacks made by Republican Kelly Loeffler in the other race, the other runoff, where she's running against Democrat, the Reverend Raphael Warnock. And Ossoff said this.
Here's the bottom line. Kelly Loeffler has been campaigning with a Klansman. Kelly Loeffler has been campaigning with a Klansman. And so she is stooping to these vicious personal attacks to distract from the fact that she's been campaigning with a former member of the Ku Klux Klan. I mean, we deserve better than that here in Georgia. And I want to encourage everybody to make a plan to vote on Tuesday.
Well, the Loeffler campaign says that she did not know about that Klansman's past when she took that photo with him that Ossoff is referring to at a campaign stop. Well, let's listen to a little bit of what John Ossoff's opponent, Senator David Perdue, has been saying after that tape of the call President Trump made with the Georgia Secretary of State this weekend. We talked about that earlier in the show. Senator Perdue went on Fox. President Trump is campaigning in Georgia today, and Perdue said he's glad that Trump will tell his supporters to get out and vote.
The people of Georgia will determine the future direction of our country. He's going to remind them of that. The people of Georgia will determine if our children will live under an oppressive socialist government or will continue to enjoy the freedoms that we all cherish. He's coming down here to help us win this election because he knows what's at stake. Not only do we need to hold off this radical socialist and very dangerous agenda the Democrats are trying to perpetrate, but also to protect what Donald Trump and this agenda has achieved over the last 4 years.
All right, so a little bit of catch up there on what's been happening on the campaign trail in Georgia. Professor Jones, let me turn to you and get your analysis on sort of what's happening in the state now, because I was looking at the election results from November that led to these two runoffs. And in the Warnock-Loeffler race, we essentially have that plurality issue, right? Reverend Warnock came away with 32.9% of the vote. Kelly Loeffler got 25% of the vote. Doug Collins got 20% of the vote. So, you know, that plurality issue there. Whereas in the Perdue-Ossoff race, David Perdue had 49.7%. John Ossoff had 47.9%. So I'm throwing a lot of numbers around here. But my point is, at least in the Perdue-Ossoff race, the fact of the runoff is the thing giving Democrat John Ossoff some hope that he might win. So what does that make you think about the utility of runoff voting, you know, in modern Georgia?
Well, I think as a nation, and in our many states, we need to be thinking about the processes of voting, mm-hmm. Because it does have this kind of impact. And so, you know, depending on the election year, you're going to come to a different conclusion. But if we voted based upon plurality, Warnock would be the senator right now. And you are absolutely correct that this would not be a contest if this runoff requirement was not there with a majority vote. So, I mean, in fact, Perdue would be the senator right now if Denmark Gruver's system was not in place.
Yeah, so, I mean, we get multiple potential outcomes there with this same system. I mean, Cal Gilson, do you want to respond to that?
I think that's absolutely right. When people talk about the runoffs, and as Professor Jones just said, that in a particular election, they can turn out one way and perhaps differently in the next election. And the question is whether or not runoffs, because they are a vestige of the past and racial motivations were part of their origin, we ought not to be doing away with them and finding other election systems, maybe plurality election systems that will give us a sort of predictable pattern of voting across the country. So the question of whether runoffs are outdated, I think, is a very real one. And, you know, if it were up to me and I could do it by myself, I would get rid of them and go to plurality voting.
Okay. Well, there are some arguments in favor of runoff voting. You know, I'm thinking of the argument where folks say that, well, it forces candidates towards the middle for the runoff itself, right? That in a plurality situation, you might end up with more extreme candidates because they don't have to convince the majority of voters, which would be sort of a more heterodox mix, that they're the right person. I mean, Professor Gilson, do you see any weight to that argument that runoffs produce a more centrist type candidate?
Well, we just played some clips from the campaign trail, John Ossoff and David Perdue, and it didn't sound to me as if they were being forced to the middle. And so,
touché.
I think that you can say about the runoff system is that they force a Democratic result, at least one version of a Democratic result, in that they force a candidate to get 50% plus one or more of the vote. And you can ask whether it would have been good for Raphael Warnock to enter the United States Senate with 32% of the vote on the first round. I think you could have a nice discussion about that.
Mm. Well, Professor Jones, I heard you laughing there in affirmation. You wanted to jump in here?
I mean, the plurality problem is that, you know, you don't necessarily have a mandate. And this allows for folks to sort of try to erode your platform from another angle. So I'm not exactly sure what the solution is, although my thinking goes more and more to vote solutions these days, because some of it is the process by which you have selected to vote in your locality, state, in the nation. You know, this has a real impact on the outcome of elections.
Mm. We've got a lot of listeners saying ranked choice voting could be an answer.
Yes. Yes, or, you know, or cumulative, or something that's more malleable, that allows people sometimes, you know, to, one, I'm an advocate of getting an election result on the same day, especially if people's votes are being used effectively. I mean, 32% doesn't do it for me, but if we have a system where we have instant runoff, for example, but people are clear that they have conveyed their opinion about who should be the representative, then I think we should be leaning towards systems that allow that.
Right. You know, this is a really interesting question to have through the lens of Georgia itself, right? Because, you know, we're talking about a system of voting, the runoff system, with this past rooted in segregation and voter suppression. I mean, that's been pretty well explored here with the two of you.
I mean, for me, the fact that this election is in Georgia is just ironic and astounding. I mean, beyond the runoffs, the state has a long history of voter suppression, and it's been a leader with regard to voter suppression. So the idea that this runoff race in this particular state is going to have an impact on the balance of power in the entire country is just... it's correct, incorrect, and amazing.
Yeah. Well, and so is there, given what you just said, and I want to talk more about other means of voter suppression that have been going on in Georgia, but is, you know, in modern Georgia today, is there anyone talking about maybe it's time to sort of change the runoff system at all?
I think people are just beginning to. We've been focused for the last several years on voter identification and similar laws, and people have begun to talk about reviving the Voting Rights Act coverage for various states, including Georgia, which I think is an important discussion. But, I mean, we've just come upon this runoff election as a result of this configuration of events. So, yes, I think it will be included in the discussion about, you know, what should elections look like.
Hmm. Professor Gilson, do you want to respond to that?
Yeah, I think that I think it's important to talk about electoral systems as packages of laws and rules. And the question about whether there are other devices beyond the runoff that are exclusionary is an important one. And you can think about things like voter ID, picture ID required for voting. Voter purges have been a big question in Georgia and across the South and really across the country, particularly in that Stacey Abrams, Brian Kemp governor's race of 2 years ago, where Kemp was the Secretary of State and engaged in purges of the voter rolls. You can think about felon restrictions on voting, which have been a very big deal in Florida and North Carolina and in other states, and I assume in Georgia as well. And then even more recently, closed polling sites and limits to early voting are all devices which, when adopted in the South, one of the reasons for their adoption is the voter impact and exclusionary effect on minority voters.
So basically, you just gave us a list there of all sorts of other places to look to help enfranchise voters in a way that might have a faster and more meaningful impact than trying to change the runoff system. So on that note, I want to listen to what's going on the ground regarding get out the vote efforts in Georgia as we come up on tomorrow's runoff. So let's listen to a moment to Deborah Scott. She's executive director of Georgia Stand Up, a Get Out the Vote organization. And she says their primary focus is Black women.
What we find is if you are authentic and talk to Black women directly about the issues that they're concerned about, and which are all kitchen table issues, that they are open and receptive and they will follow through and go vote.
And Scott says she's hopeful about the future, despite the fact that Black voters in Georgia still face voter suppression.
people are still fighting for the right to vote, but they also know that when they're fighting, they also can win. I think this November election showed them that the fight is worth it if you stay the course. And that's what we're seeing, that people are resolved that no matter what it takes, we're going to make sure our vote counts. And so that's why this race is so exciting, because you see that in the way people are showing up to the polls, and you see that in the energy and the spirit that's out there.
Which is so interesting, because a lot of Georgia voters back in November had to wait for, say, 10 hours sometimes in line to vote. Now, Deborah Scott's group, Georgia Stand Up, has been encouraging voters out at early polling locations. And last Wednesday, Ariel Singleton, one of the group's lead organizers, was out at the C.T. Martin Recreation Center in Atlanta.
Our focus today was to get voters to not only get out and vote, but those that were in line that have not voted and may be their first time voting or having to stand in line, to encourage them to stay in line and don't give up. We wanted to let them know that voting is a celebration. It's not a task. It is not something that, you know, it's not something that's gruesome to do. This is actually something that's enjoyable. It's a right. It's their power, and that they need to get out and vote for. We wanted to celebrate them for getting out to do that. So that's what we did. Gave them a party at the polls.
And Ariel and her team were kind enough to record some interviews with a couple of the voters they encountered. Here's what they heard.
In this election, I'm voting early. Very excited about that. I also was going to vote absentee, and admittedly so, I did vote absentee, but I had to spoil my ballot because they had some issues with my signature. My signature ain't changed. I'm 27 now. My signature has not changed. But they are finding like these little granular ways to make sure that people's vote isn't counted.
At the end of the day, the ancestors died for the right to vote. Please understand, whoever you are, your vote counts. Your vote is what we need in today's society for real change.
Well, that last voice you heard was Khadija Abdur-Rahman, the newly elected Fulton County Commissioner, and you also heard Laura Wiggins of Atlanta at the C.T. Martin Recreation Center in Atlanta. So thank you to Georgia Stand Up for talking to those voters for us. Adrian Jones, look, we've just got a minute left here, and I'm wondering what your last thought is on the state of Georgia, on its future elections as it's on the eve of this really pivotal runoff.
I'm thinking that it's going to take more than just a change in the runoff system to ensure that Georgians have full access to the ballot. I want everybody to be rest assured that we are going to be evaluating things like whether or not the Secretary of State will be appointed by the state legislature. I don't think there's enough power to do that. They're going to talk about whether or not to have no-fault absentee voting after this. And so Georgians who are interested in having their representative choices recognized are going to have to try to maintain this kind of enthusiasm in future elections, because it's not over. The state has been committed to discrimination for a long time and needs to be trained into a different direction, I think.
Well, Adrian Jones is assistant professor of political science at Morehouse College, speaking to us from Atlanta. Professor Jones, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
And Cal Gilson, your point about looking at voting as a whole package and trying to improve all aspects of that package is well taken. So Professor Cal Gilson, professor of political science at Southern Methodist University and author of many books on voting in American history, including Pursuing the American Dream, Opportunity and Exclusion Over Four Centuries. Professor Gilson, thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.